organizing committee, Rob, Silk, and Matt, for giving the opportunity of my word line to be here in this crossing this wonderful event. So I'm going to talk about the observability of the world effect. So in a nutshell, the UNRWA effect says that uniformly accelerated observers in Minkowski vacuum experience a thermal bath of elementary particles at temperature proportional to their acceleration. So before going into the observability of the UNRWA effect, let me give a fast chronology of the effect as I see it. So in November of 1972, Steve Fulling, he submits his famous non-uniqueness canonical field quantization in Riemannian spacetime, which was published in 73, and we can find there, he gives there, the Bogoliubov coefficients relating Minkowski and Rinder vacua, and states that it does not vanish. In his words, the notion of particles is completely different in the two theories. Almost 2 years later, analyzing a kind of related problem, Paul Davis, related in the sense that he considers for some reason an error in the origin, Paul Davis, who was a King's Scholar at that time, he, for the first time, presents the famous acceleration over 2 pi temperature, although at that time it was not really clear the meaning of this temperature. In his words, he writes, to such an accelerated observer, Rindler observers, the wall surface would appear to have a temperature of acceleration over 2 pi. The apparent production of particles is somewhat paradoxical because there is no obvious source of energy for such a production. So at that time, it seemed that some source of energy was necessary to produce what we know today to be Rindler particles of the UNRWA thermal bath. So the first place where all pieces are put together in a consistent, comprehensive way, I think it's July 1975, when Bill Rule, who was at McMaster University at that time, he gives a communication in the first Marshall Grossman meeting entitled Particle Detector and Black Holes. And you see that in the corresponding proceedings, we can read that the detector sees a thermal spectrum of particles with correct temperature. And Bill Rule told me that the effect itself was clear to him before April 1974, when he published his paper on field quantization in care metric, because there were already so much stuff there that he decided not to put something extra there. So in this sense, formally speaking, I would say that we are not only commemorating the 70th anniversary of Bill Rule and Steve Fulling, and also the first centennial of general relativity, but also the 40th anniversary of the UNRWA effect. So the reason why we do not associate, I think, the UNRWA effect with this paper is because although the talk was given in July 11th, it was a Friday in 1975, you know that the Marshall Grossman meeting has a long tradition of delaying the publication of the proceedings. This began in the first Marshall Grossman because the proceedings were published 2 years later in 77. So in between, Bill published his famous notes on black hole evaporation in a fifth rev of 1976. But interestingly, although physical rev said that it received the manuscript in August 1976, in a private communication, Steve Fulling told me that the preprint came out in early summer 1975. So from every perspective, I think we are commemorating the 40th anniversary of the UNRWA effect.
Actually, the physical review doesn't say when it received.
Oh, I think so. I think it is.
I couldn't find it. I looked.
Really?
In response to your email, I looked and at the line where they normally put the receipt date.
Oh, really?
There was nothing.
Okay. Okay. So maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe I looked in the wrong place.
Maybe.
Okay. We'd like to also call attention to Geoffrey Sewell 1981 paper, where he calls attention to the fact that for uniform accelerated observers, the Bisognano-Wichmann theorem, which was published in 76, implied Neuer effect, but nobody realized it didn't until 1981. So this is also interesting. Okay, one thing is really true, that this is a non-trivial, non-intuitive, exquisite effect, and I like to illustrate it with Richard Feynman left blackboard. There are funny things there, like, for example, what I cannot create, I do not understand. This is the left blackboard, Richard Feynman left blackboard. I know how to solve every problem that has been solved. Right, this is really fine. But at some other corner, you see something that contradicts this thing. Things to learn. And the third item is acceleration temperature. And we know that Richard Feynman knew quantum field theory, and the Neuer effect is a quantum field theory effect. And even so, you know, 12 years later, he was worried about understanding it. Even more interestingly, 4 years later, meaning today, there is still much confusion about what Neuer effect is and is not. And so I think this is a good illustration of how non-intuitive and non-trivial the effect is. So some people from the beginning decided, because of this non-triviality, to put under experimental test the effect. And as far as I know, Bell and Nayer were the first ones. They pioneered the attempt to explain experimental data in terms of Neuer effect through the depolarization of electrons in storage rings with partial success. I would say partial success because let us recall that the Neuer effect was derived for linearly accelerated observers, but Bell and Nayer, in order to get some reasonable Neuer temperature, had to consider electrons in storage rings. So it was not direct the comparison between the original Neuer effect and what they got. So after all, this illustrates the fact that between quotation marks, direct experimental confirmation is difficult, because the linear acceleration needed to reach a temperature of one single Kelvin of the Neuer thermal bath is so far there of 10 to 20 meters per square second. So for sure, sprinters do not sweat because of the Neuer effect. If they did, it would be experimental confirmation, I would say. I direct experimental confirmation. This is why. So what I would like to emphasize in this talk is that although this is true that we need 10 to 20 meters per square second to raise one Kelvin of the Neuer thermal depth, it happens that the Neuer effect does not require any verification beyond that of free quantum field theory itself. And this should be, well, in my opinion, already clear. When Biru and Bob Wald, they published their famous What Happens When an Accelerating Observer Detects a Reader Particle in 84, but I'm sure that people didn't really understand, at least completely, the paper. And this is, I think, one of the main reasons why there is still confusion about what the Neuer effect is. So what I'm going to do in the first part of this talk is to use my favorite example to try to convince people that the Neuer effect is necessary to keep quantum field theory consistent. And my favorite example is the decay of accelerated protons. So we know that inertial protons are stable according to the standard model because, for example, they cannot decay into neutrons because neutrons are heavier than protons, and this would violate energy conservation. But for accelerated protons, things are different because if you have an accelerated proton, from the point of view, say, of inertial observers, you have an external agent doing work on the proton. And this external agent doing work on the proton would be responsible to make the proton to decay to neutron for an inverse beta decay. So we can do a plain inertial observer calculation. By plain inertial observer calculation, I mean, you know, using usual quantum field theory. And if you allow me, I am going to model this inverse beta decay, assuming a semi-classical current to describe the baryonic field, meaning proton and neutron. And by semi-classical, I mean that they have a well-defined word line, but by classical, this is the classical part of the semi-classical current, and semi-classical in the sense they will still allow it to have an internal degree of freedom in order to describe a proton as being unexcited, because it's lighter, and the neutron as being the excited part of the current. The leptonic fields, meaning electrons and neutrinos, are second quantized. And we still need the interaction action. We are going to use the traditional weak interaction effective action by Fermi, where we couple the baryonic fields to the leptonic fields in this other way. Okay? And we can go ahead and do the calculation. So this is just to recall you what's the graph we are interested in. We can calculate the decay amplitude, where in the beginning you have the proton, at the end you have the neutron, positron, neutrino. This is the amplitude. We can square the absolute value of it and get the spectral distribution. We can integrate after that the right-hand side and obtain the probability, the transition probability. And eventually the proton mean proton lifetime is given by inverting the transition probability. Okay, we can go ahead, make the calculation, and the result is the following. So this is the major formula. The details are not important. The only thing I would like to mention is that this is very simple in the sense that it only depends on the Coupling constant, the electron mass, the difference between the proton neutron mass and the proton acceleration. Okay? If you put numbers, physical numbers here inside, you get this simple graph saying that the larger the acceleration, the smaller the proton mean proton lifetime. That's it. When acceleration is zero, the proton is stable. Okay, this is a plain calculation, no problem about that. But now, what we want to do is to reobtain this from the point of view of accelerated observers. Okay? And from the point of view of accelerated observers, I mean winter observers, which are described by these hyperbolas in blue. And in red, we have the corresponding space-like hypersurfaces. And because I'm going to plane between inertial and accelerated calculations, inertial observer and accelerated observer calculations, I would like to make a distinction to make it easier to the audience to follow it. And rather than when I do the calculation from the point of view of accelerated observers, I'm going to use this kind of... I'm going to plot the Wimbler coordinates in this way, where the hyperbolas here are described by straight lines, psi equal to going to minus infinity, which approaches the horizon, is given by a straight line at the psi going minus infinity. You have psi plus infinity. These are the corresponding red space-like hypersurfaces. And this is nice because this makes it evident that the proton neutron current is static with respect to Rinder observers.
Are you neglecting the coupling to electromagnetic field?
Yeah. I have some external agent accelerating the proton. So I'm not telling, I'm not saying here how this proton neutron is being accelerated. I'm just saying that something is accelerating
it. But even still, it would radiate.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm neglecting it. I'm only interested about the decay of the proton neutron. I'm going to talk about the radiation emitted at the second part. Okay, the problem now is that according to Rinder observers, the current is static. And so they cannot use the same argument that inertial observers use it to justify how protons can decay into neutrons, because inertial observers use the argument that there is some work being done to the problem. But work depends on two ingredients. Force, which for sure exists because this is the proper acceleration is different from zero, and displacement. And there's no displacement here because the current is static. So there's no work, actually. So according to linear observers, because there is no displacement on the proton neutron, they are static with respect to them, they cannot use the argument that some work has been done on the proton to justify this process. So this process does not happen with respect to accelerated observers. So if we don't add something to the problem, Rinder observers would conclude, in agreement with inertial observers, that uniform accelerated protons would be stable. But happily, there is something else. Happily, the Urbach effect says that the Minkowski vacuum corresponds to the thermal bed of elementary particles with respect to Rinder observers. And so there's a chance that the proton becomes a neutron by absorbing the energy from particles of the Urbach thermal bed. So the idea is to make an independent calculation where the proton absorbs, reacts, or interacts with the particles of the Urbach thermal bed and see whether they obtain or not the same proton mean proper lifetime we obtain with inertial observers. So there are three important channels here. The first one is this one, where a proton decays into a neutron by the absorption of an electron and emission of the excedent energy in terms of neutrinos, and so on and so on and so forth, for the absorption of antineutrinos and emission of positrons, and absorption of antineutrinos and absorption of electrons. We can even ask them which of these. First, let me continue. So the baryonic field, proton neutron, is going to be precisely the same. We are going to use precisely the same semi-classical current we use it for inertial observers. The loop interaction effective action is, again, precisely the same we consider for inertial observers. The only difference is that the lepton fields are going to be expanded in terms of positive and negative frequency with respect to Rinder observers, meaning Rinder modes. And in order to, because this is the natural thing to do with respect to Rinder observers, and in order to convince those who are not so familiar with this that this expansion is independent or non-trivially independent from the expansion in terms of plane waves, I emphasize that although, for example, electrons are massive, the Rinder frequency associated with electrons can be smaller than the mass of the electron, go from zero to infinity, right? Okay, because the usual dispersion relation in Minkowski spacetime for Minkowski particle is not valid for Rinder particles. Okay, so let's go ahead and illustrate the calculation for one of the channels. In the first channel, the proton becomes a neutron by the absorption of electrons from the Urbach thermal bed and emission of the neutrino. The decay amplitude is similar. In the beginning, you have the proton electron. At the end, you have the neutron neutrino. Then we do exactly the same thing. We calculate the spectral distribution by squaring the absolute value of the amplitude. But we have to remember that now we are in a thermal bed, so we have to multiply the right-hand side by a term, a Fermi-Dirac statistical term, because this electron is being absorbed from a thermal bed, and here is the room temperature. And we have also to multiply by another factor in order to take into account that this neutrino is being emitted in the Fermi-Dirac, in the Urbach thermal bed. And because we use the Fermi-Dirac statistics because we are talking about thermals. Okay, then we integrate the right-hand side over the transverse momentum of electrons and neutrinos, and again, the transition probability. We do the same for the other two channels. We have the transition probabilities for one, two, and three channels, which are independent. We can even ask reader observers what's the branching ratio between these three channels. And they will tell us that, look, when the temperature is small with respect to the scale given by the neutron, proton, and electron mass, these two channels dominate over these. And when the temperature is small, or that ratio is small, this channel dominates over these. But this is not what we're interested in. We are not interested about how reader observers see the world, but we are interested really whether or not the way they see the world is consistent or not with the way inertial observers, with the observables that inertial observers calculate. Okay, so once we have the transition probabilities, we add up these transition probabilities incoherently because they are different channels, inverted, and we have the proton mean proper lifetime as calculated independently by linear observers. And the answer is, when we go and do the calculations, a value that is identical to the initial observer result. And we only obtained this because we used the Dirac effect. If we didn't use the Dirac effect, the timeline would be infinite, because according to linear observers, in the absence of the Dirac thermal bath, protons would be stable in disagreement with inertial observers. So thanks to the Dirac thermal bath, this quantum field calculation is consistent with inertial and accelerated frames. Just a caution remark, because I see that still there is confusion in the literature about that, so this is just a parenthesis in my transparency, that although we have shown that how we can calculate the proton mean proper lifetime with respect to inertial and accelerated observers and get consistent result, this doesn't mean that if you consider an inertial proton rather than uniform accelerated proton, inertial proton in a thermal bath equal to the one of the Dirac thermal bath, the mean proper lifetime for proton to become neutron would be the same, although the detailed balance relation is the same, are compatible. Okay? This is not what the Dirac effect says. And this difference is precisely coherent, consistent, and it doesn't challenge the Dirac effect, because this is not what the Dirac effect says.
Is there a difference?
Yeah. They are different.
Normal modes are different.
Oh, yeah.
That's what.
Yeah. The detailed balance relation agrees, but the observable, the time life of the proton, of this inertial proton, it coincides in one single case when we consider Rudewitt detectors interacting with massless scalar fields. If we consider with massive scalar fields, this is already different. I mean, the excitation rate is already different.
What about massless scalar fields in dimension, space-time dimension other than two?
I don't know.
So already,
but this is a coincidence.
But the transverse momentum means that the normal modes are the modified Bessel functions, not plane lines.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, I would rather not say, okay, rather than guess wrongly.
Yeah, can I ask?
Yeah.
When you describe the Rindler frame calculation, you sort of talked about it as if you were in an inertial frame in terms of this, the way you set up the quantum calculation. But in fact, when you calculated to get that answer, did you have mode functions in the calculation? Or did the fact that you're a Rindler only come in, say, through the dispersion relation or something?
No. This, when we do the calculation, I don't know if this is what you're asking, but let me see. If it's not you, please ask again. When I talk about Rindler observer calculation, the key point is to expand the quantum field in terms of positive and negative Rindler modes.
Okay, so the mode overlaps are explicitly evaluated.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. explicitly removed. Thank you. So this actually, I think, this is a confusion. Let me confess my crime. For some reason, I thought that this should be equal because of Biro and David's example, which uses precisely massless scalar fields coupled with world with detectors, and this is equal. And I thought for some time that this was what the new effect said. So anyway. Okay, please.
And in the case of the Gibbons Hawking effects, when you could say particle detector in the Sitter universe, that the response function of the detector is three-dimensional, three space dimensions, and in that case the response function of the detector is identical for a thermal state of the uniform temperature and the expanding universe. In that case, in that particular case. So I was wondering, because that question that was asked about the higher dimensions, if they would be the same or not in massless field for the higher dimensions.
In high dimension, Kadama calculated long time ago, there is a article. So as I remember, it happens that if you change from 4 to 5, basically it looks like Fermi statistics.
Right, right.
So for this reason, it's quite different. And the reason is that because you have phase volume, and it becomes anisotropic in this case,
right,
instead of cosmology. So anisotropic phase volume change it factor.
I see. Okay, but it would be the same for even dimensions. It would be eternal for even dimensions.
Yeah.
Okay.
For all masses.
For all masses and all dimensions.
I don't remember.
That's it?
Thank you. Okay, so how do I like to see the new effect? I like to see the new effect as a complicated, exquisite, non-trivial quantum field theory inertial force. In what sense? Different observers may disagree about how they describe the world or how they interpret physical phenomena. For example, in the case we gave here, according to inertial observers, the proton decays to neutrons by the emission into the vacuum of photons and neutrinos, while according to Ritter observers, the proton decays into a neutron by the absorption of electrons and antineutrinos from the thermal vac and emitting the accidental energy in terms of neutrinos and photons. But they cannot agree on scalar physical observables, namely, in our case, the proton mean proton lifetime. So the same happens for inertial forces. We know that inertial and non-inertial observers will disagree about the description of, say, if you throw a ball towards the boundary of this disk, and including, we know that rotating observers have to add in their mechanical calculation the fictitious forces, centrifugal, Euler, and centripetal, and Coriolis in general, but they cannot agree on the physical observable, namely in this case, where the ball is going to hit at the boundary of this disk. And in other words, the summary of the first part of this seminar. One cannot trust usual free quantum field theory in the inertial frame and doubt the new effect, as well as one cannot trust usual classical mechanics in the inertial frame and doubt the existence of non-inertial forces. And for all purposes, these non-inertial forces are as true for these non-inertial observers as the Uhl effect is for Rinder observers. This is not an illusion. For accelerated observers, this is a fact. Okay, this is one thing. Something different is that I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying, in the sense that the fact that new effects are necessary to keep free quantum field theory consistent does not make the search for lab phenomena, which may be explained more naturally with respect to window observers in terms of new effect, less interesting. Why? Because this is not trivial. This is not trivial. For example, let's go back to the proton example. If you wonder how long a proton at LHC is stable, you end up with the result, if you put numbers there, you end up with the result that protons would need at LHC much, 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 much more than the age of the universe to decay. This is very bad for, this is very good for accelerator physics, but very bad for us. If you go to a cosmic scenario and consider high energy protons with such an energy in the magnetic field of pulsars with 10 to 14 Gauss, things are better, about 1% of incident protons will decay, but this is very difficult to observe. More recently, Morgan Lynch, he suggested that this analogous process of accelerated electrons decaying to muons may be observable in the ice cube. I don't know what's the present status of that. Maybe you can add something at the end, if you want. But, and there is a number of other tentatives. I don't know, I don't have time or even knowledge to discuss all of them. There are some reviews about that. But I would like to spend my last minutes, my last 15 minutes, discussing one particular interesting example, in my opinion. And this is the observation signals of the UR effect in ultra-intense lasers, or the manifestation of the UR effect in ultra-intense lasers. So the idea was, I think, firstly posed by Shen and Tajima, who considered the following. Accelerated electrons would quiver as they back react to the radiation emission. The observation of such quivering. This is a quiver. Sound effect. The observation of such quivering would be naturally interpreted, say, by some extra radiation, would be naturally interpreted by wind observers as interaction of electrons with the UR thermal bed. This idea was elaborated by Schultz, Holt, Schaller, and Hess, and basically the idea, I hope I am being, I hope this graph shows correctly, the idea is, from the point of view of wind observers, these uniform accelerated electrons would interact and scatter Rinder photons from the UR thermal bed. Right? So they consider Thomson scattering of Rinder photons in the Rinder frame. It happens that because of the paper by Bob Lod and Bill Rue about detector and what happens when a particle is absorbed by a detector, we know that the absorption of this Rinder photon corresponds in the inertial frame to the emission of Minkowski photon. So from the point of view of inertial observers, this very natural process would correspond to the emission of correlated photons. So the emission of, observation of correlated photons in the inertial frame would correspond, could be naturally interpreted in terms of the UR effect here. And it would be really very nice. The point here, the difficulty here is that in order to see some reasonable signal, you need ultra-intense lasers. And after all, the reason is because you have basically three vertices, one, two, and then third vertex associated with the acceleration of the electron by some external agent. And this is why you need ultra-intense lasers. Okay. So what I would like to discuss now is whether we could see a signal or whether we could look at a simpler process, namely the usual Larmor or Bremsstrahlung radiation emission, which is much, much easier because you have only one photon being emitted, and see the UR effect hidden here inside. If we can do it, then it would be good news because this is much easier to observe. Okay, let us see. Let us analyze this problem from the point of view of psi and reader observers. From the point of view of reader observers, we have here our uniform accelerated electron, which interacts with the Uru thermal bed of photons. But it happens that our electron is static and it doesn't have internal degrees of freedom. So it can only interact with zero energy reader photons. Well, the good news is that zero energy reader photons are not boring as zero energy Minkowski photons, because zero energy Minkowski photons also have vanishing three momentum, while zero energy reader photons still carry transverse momentum. Why? Again, because the dispersion relation, the inertial dispersion relation valid for Minkowski particles is not valid for Rinder particles. Okay, well, meaning that we can talk of zero energy Rinder photons and still have quantum numbers to label that. Okay, then we can go ahead and wonder what the absorption probability of these uniform accelerated electrons of absorbing zero energy Rinder photons from the Uru thermal bed and emitting zero energy Rinder photons from the Uru thermal bed. We model our electron by a classical current. The interaction action is the usual one, and the Rinder photons are expanded usually through Rinder modes, using Rinder modes. Okay, let's go again and look at one of the two channels. The absorption amplitude is given here, usually here, and in order to get the transition probability, or in this case, absorption probability, we have to square the absolute value of the amplitude and multiply here, not by the Fermi-Dirac statistical factor, by the Bose-Einstein statistical factor, because we are talking about bonds. The point here is that when you go and make the calculation, you get a indeterminacy. Why? Let's understand it. This delta is because our static electron can only interact with zero energy Rinder photons. This zero is because this is very zero energy Rinder photons. I have a transcribe for this. This zero is because zero energy Rinder photons concentrate on the horizon, meaning psi equal to minus infinity. And this is very difficult for the electron to interact with something that's far away and does not lag to the Rinder edge. So this zero is because this amplitude for an electron, for a photon in the vacuum, goes to zero. On the other hand, there is an infinite number of zero energy photons trying to interact with the electron. And you can see it by just inserting his, making it zero. Zero energy with the photons, put it zero, you have one over zero, you have this infinity here. So you have a competition between the fact that this is very difficult for these particles to interact with our electron versus the fact that you have an infinite number of zero energy photons trying to interact with the electron. So we have to raise this indeterminacy. In order to do it, we replace our static charge by a dipole, oscillating dipole. When you do it, and it oscillates with frequency E, you go into the calculation, and you see that now our dipole does not interact well. Our dipole now interacts with finite energy E Rinder photons. And the indeterminacy is raised because now we get a function of E. But we're not interested about the spectral distribution of this dipole. We are interested on our static current. So we want to recover our current from this. In order to do it, we need a double link. Firstly, we have to push our charge, our second charge, to infinity, because when psi zero goes to infinity, this means that this charge becomes inert, because this charge becomes inertia. And you can see it explicitly in the calculations. That when you do it, this charge doesn't contribute to the result. The second thing is that this E has to be made to go to zero in order to stop this oscillation. So in other words, in order to recover our original source charge, electric charge, we have to make this double limit in this result. And the answer is a perfectly well-defined result, which depends. So this is the absorption probability per transverse momentum of the photon, which is a function of this transverse momentum and the acceleration. And we can do it again, repeat the calculation for the emission of zero energy photons. And the result is precisely the same. But again, now, remember Bob Wald and Bill Root paper that the absorption of Rinder photons from the point of view of Rinder observers will correspond to the emission of a Minkowski photon according to inertial observers. So we are in a position to make a prediction. A prediction that came from a calculation that used the Bill Root effect, namely these two results. The prediction is that if inertial observers do an experiment with uniform accelerated charge and measure the emission rate of photons from this uniform accelerated charge in the vacuum, they are going to observe, they, inertial observers, are going to measure in their experiment this transition probability, this emission, radiation emission, per fixed transverse momentum. Two times this, because I'm just adding up this result by this result. Then we can go ahead and ask, go ahead and do like Silk and do the experiment, but we are not brave enough. We don't know how to do this experiment. But then we say, okay, let's do a theoretical calculation. But we're talking about a theoretical calculation, very simple, that nobody doubts, because we are talking about the inertial calculation of photon emission at the tree level. So actually, nobody is going to doubt this result unless we have some algebraic error. So in order to do this calculation in the inertial frame, we use the same current, we use the same direction action, and we expand the photon field in terms of plane waves, as usual. We go ahead and verify the predictions. So I don't know if I was convincing enough, but the idea here was to convince you that the usual Bremsstrahlung radiation may be seen as routine lab manifestation of the UFO effect.
Does this version of calculation require regularization?
The only regularization is this one.
No, so this version I understand, but the Bremsstrahlung calculation?
No. I see. No, because I don't know if this is what you mean, but if you integrate the right hand side over the transverse momentum, you get an infinite, which is the infraviolet. No, because this is a tree level. So you don't need anything.
Is it quantum or classical?
Well, you can, after all, you can re-obtain this using classical electromagnetism. But you have to interpret, in terms of because this is the emission probability of photons. So you can do, in Quasdom actually, the calculation using a classical electromagnetism, and after you interpret your field in terms of photons, you end up again with the same result.
For the energy flux, there will be no H, yes? For the energy rate of the energy emission, it will be no H.
No, yeah.
We don't speak about single photons and so rate of emission of energy.
Yeah.
It will be no H.
No H at all.
Okay.
Here we are.
So maybe I can.
After all, this is when you calculate the power emitted, we're talking about the Larmor formula. Okay. Yeah.
So I just want to express a view. I'm not sure I share my view, but so if I choose an interpretation for this result, and I observe that in this version of the calculation, I don't have to use tricks. I can just straightforwardly get the result. The unreal interpretation where I have to regularize and apply some tricks in order to get something sensible, I might be tempted to say that this is a better interpretation because the calculation is cleaner.
Is also cleaner, unless the also calculation is as clean as this one, but the only difference that we have to make, you know, first begin with this dipole and then take this.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. I may choose not to like this,
therefore
tend to reject the interpretation because of that.
I see. I expected something like that. So when I was preparing this talk, I thought, look, somebody's going to tell you that. Right? And so we decided, and we are doing it there, expecting for something I will... to do this calculation, not this calculation with uniform accelerated charge, but circularly moving charge with respect to reader observers, because in this case, they are going to interact with non-zero reader photons, and no regularization is going to be necessary. So I hope you soon, I will send you the paper. I hope soon we have a paper where everything goes the same, and there is no necessity to this regularization. Okay? Okay. Very good. So I'm around to the end. The conclusion is that of this part is that the usual branch graph. But by your objection, I hope that you agree with that. Excluding the only trick is that small trick. Okay, but I see, this is why I said, I hope you allow me the conclusion, and I hope I allow you, you allow me the conclusion is because I was thinking that somebody would not allow me the conclusion. Okay, as a byproduct, this also, this previous example also answered in the negative, the long-standing question, whether or not post-rated observers with a charge see radiation. The answer is no. Why not? Because according to Rinder observers co-accelerated with charge, the charge is emitting zero energy photons which concentrate on the horizon. So this is not something that Rinder observers can observe unless they go into on the horizon with infinite acceleration. And in order to, well, I remember when we got this, when we were spending 1 year at the Bob Waltz department, in order to sleep well, we always remember Steve Fulton's paper. He taught us that in Bob Waltz's words, I put them under quotations because I hope I'm quoting precisely as I remember you telling us 24 years ago. You correct me if I'm wrong, if I remember. In general, different observers extract distinct particle contents from the same theory. This is why, this is the main content, I think, of Steve Fulton's paper, and this is why it's perfectly possible that, it's perfectly possible that inertial observers see radiation going out from a uniform accelerated charge, although co-accelerated observers, they only see a modified Coulomb field associated to this charge. But in order to make a deeper interpretation of this, namely that the emission of each Minkowski photon from this charge from the point of view of inertial observers corresponds to the either absorption or emission of a Rinder photon, of a Rinder photon, in order to allow this deeper interpretation, you need the Roux thermal bed. And you know, I prepared this transparency in the whole seminar, not here, but at home, and I'm very happy to see that in this seminar, I'm naming the two people that are making their anniversary this year. So, Steve Foote and Bill Roux. So I'm finishing. My final conclusion is very, very simple, probably the simplest one in this fest. The Roux effect lives among us. And my final words is, congratulations. Thank you very, very much. You've had an incredible, tremendous, massive influence in my scientific career. And thank you also Steve Foley and Bob Wall, because you were also very, very important to me. So thank you very much to all of you.
Actually, I can make a comment. You had mentioned that ice cube paper. What he was looking at was this acceleration-induced proton decay, this inverse beta decay with protons. And what Ted Jacobson had commented on is, if you have some external agent that's accelerating you, you're going to be emitting Bremsstrahlung at the same time. And so what that ice cube one does, it actually uses the Bremsstrahlung itself as not the mechanism of acceleration, but deceleration, using the stopping power of electrons in ice. And so what's interesting is it takes that exact phenomenon into account and not kind of ignores it. And then when you actually use the Bremsstrahlung, it kind of a priori already assumes all of the necessary coherences and things to induce the Roux effect are already there. Because as you've seen, that there is this interpretation of Bremsstrahlung from the Roux effect. And so it kind of combines both of them together with this, not proton, but in this case an electron, but using the Bremsstrahlung as well as the mechanism of deceleration to induce the decay. And so it kind of wraps them all together. Thank you.
I'd like to make a further comment on Eric's comment. Just a reminder that the classical Larmor radiation from a uniformly accelerated charge, where the uniform acceleration lasts forever, is itself notoriously subtle and has occasionally been controversial. I think all of the judge's point is that all these things illuminate each other, right? We keep learning more. And I still don't feel like I understand everything. No.
Neither do I. Definitely. Yeah.
It's a bit of perhaps a stupid question, but I mean, in my presentation, I explained all these difficulties of really showing quantum mass and that there are classical sources sometimes which basically dominate the whole effect. So if you do an experiment, suppose you could do an experiment, right? Could there also be a completely classical interpretation of that?
Of your effect?
Yeah, how would this, we're just talking about the real world, in a sense, and there are small complications and all this. So could there be, what would you see the main difficulty in order to really isolate the quantum? To really say this is an amplification, it's something driven from quantum fluctuations rather than some classical.
Okay, well, I don't know if this is what you expect from me, but let me tell you that the Roux temperature depends on the age, right? So it comes out from, I don't know if I should say this because you have, Bob Wall, the Roux, and Steve, and all you guys, you want me to be precise, but I like to say, that I like to think at least, although I don't tell this in public, that the Roux effect is as uniform accelerated observers see as real those particles that inertial observers define as being virtual. And this is codified in the H-bar that is in the Euro temperature. You have a h bar multiplied acceleration over 2 pi, you have a c. So the Euro, definitely the Euro effect is a quantum effect. Right. Although, let's remember that in order to apply it for the emission radiation, well, you are applying this to the radiation being emitted, then you have a classical counterpart. So we are talking like a quantum effect being applied in a problem that in the inertial frame has a classical interpretation. We have a paper where with Atsushi Higuchi where we analyze a similar problem to this using classical electromagnetism and using a way of interpreting the electromagnetic field in terms of particles. Then we end up with a kind of classical Uhuru thermal map. But you know there is a this is, well, I have to tell the details in order not to be. Definitely the Uhuru effect is a quantum effect.
But in terms of Uhuru temperature, where you may say Uhuru frequency or Uhuru length, they will not contain H. So basically, it's when we're speaking. So if there is no zero-point fluctuation or some kind of quantum, especially simulated emission, you may just take words without H. So for this reason, classical and quantum for emission of photons are the same.
I don't know if that's what you mean.
Do you mean
that if we replace vacuum fluctuations by classical random kind of random field?
No, I mean another thing. So in your formula, we have E squared divided by acceleration. So basically, C squared over acceleration is just length. And H does not enter for this formula for electromagnetic radiation.
If you actually compute the, for example, you can compute the power radiant, but if you remember the interpretation was the emission absorption of zero energy Rinder photons, which implies a change in energy of Rinder space of delta E equals zero. And when you have that in the, because the only place where H bar enters into the computation is in the thermal distribution. And so when delta E equals zero, that thing washes out. And so when delta E doesn't equal zero, the H bar remains. So when you look at the Bremsstrahlum, delta equals zero, the H bar washes out, and it remains a classical effect. But whenever it's not equal zero, for a case with the proton decay, where you have an energy gap, the H bar then becomes fully resolvable in that case.
Okay, Pets, I had a comment on Feynman's blackboard.
What?
Comment
on the blackboard? Feynman's blackboard?
Yeah.
Okay, a second. Yes, a second.
This is maybe a minor point, but I actually think you read part of it incorrectly. Mm-hmm. It says know how to solve every problem that has been solved. I don't think that means I know how. It's an order to himself. It's an instruction to himself to learn.
Oh, really?
Capital K.
It's capital K, right?
Oh, I see. So, thank you.
I think that's a very good last word, so that you can.
Okay, let's